Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. I'm Jonathan London, your host. And if this is your first Geekscape, well, strap yourselves in for some pop culture talk. Sometimes that means news, sometimes reviews, and sometimes it's an interview with a filmmaker, someone from the video game world or comic book world. That's what we love here, and that's what we talk about. This episode, we've got a great one. I've got filmmaker Neil LaBute. He has a brand new film called House of Darkness. I think it's fantastic. I had a lot of fun watching it, and you horror fans are gonna love it. Speaking of horror, how cool was Joe Dante? If you didn't hear my interview with Joe Dante, go back in the feed, one episode. We talked a little bit of Gremlins. We talked about one of my favorite TV shows as a kid, Eerie Indiana. And I got to tell Joe that I think Gremlins is the greatest Christmas movie of all time. It was a short interview, but I loved doing it. And I think you can hear just how nervous I am during it. That being said, I had a great time. And if you missed it, go back in the feed and listen to it. I've got some great episodes of Geekscape coming up, so please hit that subscribe button, share your favorite episodes with your friends. But for now, let's get going. Here's the episode with Neil LaBute. Hey, Geekscapists, I've got a treat for you right now. Playwright and filmmaker Neil LaBute is here. He's got a brand new film, House of Darkness. It's available in theaters September 9th in on-demand and digital September 13th. And I watched the movie. If you're a horror fan, you're going to love it. If you're really a fan of Neil's, I think you're going to love it because it's got all the pieces that are like your signatures. Wouldn't you say that this is a horror movie, but through your lens?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's probably a great way to describe it. Yeah, it starts out feeling like one thing and then morphs into something else along the way. And hopefully that's a fun ride.
What I loved about it, and I remember back in the 90s in the Company of Men.
Yeah.
And the way you discovered Aaron Eckhart, who I guess you went to college with.
That's right.
Sometimes you can describe your movies as cruel, but I think I don't know if you can judge them. Does that make sense? Like, I think as a storyteller, you try not to judge your character.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. I don't know that it always makes sense to an audience. Sometimes they feel like, you know, they're too distanced or, you know, there's this kind of, you know, cool or cruel veneer to some of the things and they don't want to be a part of that. But, you know, you hope that you create an experience that that feels like it's authentically your own and that people will embrace it because it's different, but not everybody does. I had very split reactions to most things and probably will to this.
Is that what you're going for though? And I mean, is it a search for some level of catharsis with you where you say, okay, like if you're living in a society of, let's just say it's, personal repression or, especially in a movie like this, not being allowed to be who you are or thinking that you have to align yourself with a lie in order to protect others or protect yourself. And it is still a lie, that sort of morality play that you're always working with. Where does that come from? What level of, again, catharsis are you looking for whenever you put the pen to the paper?
Well, I think those questions are interesting as, you know, for people just, whether it's in your entertainment or just in your conversation across the dinner table. So I hope that I'm picking up on things that are, you know, not even necessarily in the zeitgeist, but just are big common questions that we ask of ourselves and each other. And then you filter that into the work that you're doing as an entertainment that you can, it's okay to entertain and instruct or, you know, bring up something that's interesting to you as a person and not even have a, you know, an instructive quality to it. It's not that. It's so much as hey, I've been thinking about this a lot and I'm going to have characters think about it as well.
And are they based on anybody sometimes? Where does some of these stories originate?
Rarely my stuff, you know, can I say 100%? No. But I can very easily say mostly no. Most of these things are just from the imagination, you know, just me coming up with stories. That's the job. I'm trying to be a storyteller. And so you come up each day looking for something new to tell, or a way into a story. You know, it's not like we haven't seen a man and a woman, you know, drive to his or her place. And what happens next is this. There's been a lot of those stories. So to tell another one today, you have to have a legitimately, hopefully different take on that than what you've seen before.
Well, what I love about your movies is that if you had that road trip movie, and let's just call this a road trip movie, it's a bit of a bottle movie. It feels like you're going back to your playwright roots with this thing. It is very much a play in limited acts. And Geekscape is, I loved it. I'm not even the biggest horror fan, as you listeners know, but I loved this movie because, again, it's through Neil's lens. And if you have that road trip movie, usually a road trip movie is a fairly easy script to do because the hurdles for the characters are external things that they encounter on the road. With your movies, though, those hurdles are always the other person they're writing with and the things inside that are being dredged up. And that's what I thought was fascinating here is ultimately this is digging to the truth of who these characters are.
Right.
And what kind of, I mean, your writing process, do these things start out as externalizations that you internalize, or do you like inhabiting within the internalization and dredging this stuff into externalizations?
It's a little of both. You know, I start out with the idea comes in whatever way. I usually don't spend time bullet pointing, like scene by scene, or I know exactly how long every moment is going to be. I may very well see the goalposts. You know, I may have said, I know how this is going to end. Mm-hmm. And so I'll find my way there as a writer by searching. You know, I may write myself into a corner and have to back out and, you know, go down the hallway a different way. That certainly has happened many times to me. But I think that process, when it's been most effective, has been the similar experience for an audience, that it feels like a mystery trying to get there. They don't usually get ahead of the story. They have to figure their and feel their way there as well as they watch. So that's the best experience that I think I can offer, is one that feels like a unique version of whatever it is that they're seeing. Oh, this is a marriage piece. This is a piece, you know, about two people who just met cute or whatever. You know, you're going to see a legitimately different take on it. And as you write, different things creep in. I tend to not start with theme, like, oh, this is going to be about this. It's a little more matter of fact about, I'm taking these two people, I'm putting them in a room, and I'm going to see what happens. And theme kind of comes out of that.
And that's part of your exploratory process.
I think so.
Yeah. There's a meet cute. In this movie, Geekscape is very much starts with a meet cute. And I really enjoyed listening to the words just kind of come out. And I felt like it did have that exploratory sense for me. Is, again, the movie's fairly minimal on set pieces. And it is two people talking. And they're in a meet cute. And Hap is dropping Mina off. They don't even know each other's names. And it's always good to see Justin Long and Kate Bosworth again. And they're kind of feeling this thing out, and they have secrets, as they do in most of your films. These people have secrets, and it's just where are they going to slip on those secrets? Where are the tells come out? How do you pick up on the tells? And I also love that you, in your films, you're not rushing to do the camera tricks. You're just kind of documenting these things, almost like those stage plays that you put together. And it's up to the audience to kind of watch this and say, hey, I picked up on it. Did they pick up on it? Or, oh, I missed it. But something just shifted there. There's an energy that shifted. And Neil is, oh, there's a push going in, or there's a little bit of a slight move. Neil wants us to pay attention. And that's kind of what I love about the energy in this movie.
Yeah.
How much of that stuff was, how much of this script is set in stone when Justin and Kate show up? And
stone
how
much is never, you know, yeah, liquid cement. maybe, you know, but it's always pliable. It's you try and lay a really good blueprint down, and one that feels very sturdy to you. And I, as a director, I try and go in with a way to do things. You know, I think about every scene and go, okay, I mean, like this thing, as you say, you know, it's a very limited number of locations in terms of this one big castle, you know, home in the woods. But you still have to figure out, how long are we going to spend in the library? How long are we going to go outside? How long are we going to come back in and go into the living room? And why, and what makes sense there? Because, you know, someone can come visit you at your home. You can happily sit on the couch the whole evening and talk. You know, you might get up, go to the bathroom, go to get water, but it's not to, to make the picture more interesting. But often we feel like in movies or on stage, we've got to keep people moving around or it won't be interesting. I'm very interested in what people say. And just those, as you say, those little minutiae of a shift in the, or the silence in what isn't said. You know, why did I not say something there? Because you caught me off guard. And so capturing those with these actors. What happens is you have these actors who come in and breathe life into these characters. And something that I've done a lot of my career is cast people who I think have a currency with the audience that goes beyond them as actors, often just as people. Like you take someone like Justin and people, you know, if someone sees a picture of Justin, they're like, oh, I like that guy. They might not even be able to say what his name is. They're like, oh, he's fun. Yeah, he's funny.
He sold me a phone back in the 2000s. I remember that guy.
Exactly. That's, you know, that's, they feel like they know him. You know what I mean? And yeah. Oh yeah, he's really funny. And so there's a lot of goodwill going into it. So I think he's getting away with a lot of stuff in the movie even that another actor might not. You might immediately go, just call bluff on that. Like, this guy's kind of an asshole. This guy's, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He's just trying to get in her pants. Whatever it is that they go with someone like Justin and they're like, they think, oh, he's a nice guy, you know? And this guy is self-professed a nice guy, you know, in the movie, but you watch him grow from this guy who drops her off and like, oh, I wasn't even thinking about coming in, to you hear behind the scenes what he's really thinking. And then, you know, all that time he's in a position of presumed power. Like he's in a place where he feels like he's controlling the events of the evening, and anything that puts him off that game is interesting to watch how it registers on him. Right down toward the very end of the film, where he still kind of feels like, I'm going to go home now. I've had enough of your crap. You know, and you see what happens after those moments happen. But it's fun to watch how that character's security disintegrates throughout the process, and how still Kate can be and just, you know, just stare at you with these eyes, and you're looking at this very pretty face. And someone who's been, you know, often like the love interest in stuff. And, you know, and yet you're looking at her going, there's something, I don't know if I trust this person, you know, but he doesn't see it. All he sees is this pretty face and what looks like it's going to be a great evening.
If anything, those silences, I think, are what worked. Like I said, with the camera movements, like just letting us as an audience get drawn in the same way the characters are getting, the same way that Justin really is getting drawn into this.
Yeah, the audience house. Hopefully is happening at the same time. We need to
fill the gaps, and you're giving us the room. I mean, I think a more insecure filmmaker would have tried to fill those gaps, either with camera movement, with dialogue, with more cuts, this and that. But you're just, did you always have that confidence? Is that something that, if I go back and watch In the Company of Men, which I haven't seen honestly since it came out,
very long takes with very few, not much cover,
does that come from theater where you're just like, hey, we go live and that's what it, where it lands?
Part of it is just liking films that are shot that way. You know, I've always been a fan of that kind of like long takes where you're watching both actors in the frame. But here also, you know, I would want to mention, you know, the team you're working with, especially Daniel Katz, who shot the film. He had to have the same confidence. You know what I mean? He also, he did a few creeps that I probably didn't even know about, you know, where like the camera just slightly shifts in on somebody, you know, and you can only just kind of emotionally feel it. You don't even almost notice it. You know
it's right, but I like watching the frames. If you watch the frames, you can slowly be like, oh, it moved.
Exactly. It's changing a little bit, but you didn't notice it. He was really, you know, gifted and not only lit it beautifully, but also, you know, shot at himself and kept a very steady hand on, I also wanted to go for the ride of like, I don't want to shoot a bunch of coverage and we don't have time for it. You know, we're shooting this very quickly. So let's let the actors do the work and enjoy the ride.
No, what I like about it is that you don't draw from the horror well of energy equating to audio jump scares and quick cuts and kind of those slaps in the face to the audience to say, hey, yeah, you're supposed to jump here because I just slapped you audibly.
Yeah, or visually. I played the music so loud, you should have jumped.
Yeah, like, the it's more of a tone. It's more of a creeping, just you want to, by the end of this, you want to get out of that house as much as Hap does, Justin's character. And one question is, like, clearly on this one, and Geekscape is, you got to watch this movie. It's out on September 9th on in theaters and on demand in September 13th. This felt like you designed it from the last sequence backwards. And some of your movies with the role reveals and the way it's like, hey, but at the end, there's going to be this Hitchcock-like twist internally with the characters where there's irony, where there's tragedy, where there's a bit of maybe satisfaction to some people. And you feel like sometimes the magic trick has been designed backwards. And I don't mean to just like water your stuff down to magic tricks. It's not. There's a lot of thought and design that goes into it. Have you ever started to say, okay, if that's the ending, let me work my way back towards the early or the beginning? And as you start to explore these characters in drafts, as you start to familiarize yourself with them and they become strangers, then friends, then family members in subsequent drafts, have they ever surprised you and refused to meet that ending that you had predestined for them?
Sure, sure. That's very well put. I haven't heard it put that way before. Absolutely. You know, so, and sometimes you get out the tools and go, oh, you don't think you're going to go there.
I'm going to force you in this hammer
that I've got here because I'm about to knock you senseless until I get you to fit into that hole.
Is that always good to do, or does it fight the organic nature of your process?
But I'm saying that I have found myself doing that, going, hey, I wrote those 90 pages. Now we're going where I want to go at the end of this.
Is studio intervention, maybe? We can put it on and say, I mean, listen, you're going to have this set piece.
Divine intervention is anybody else reading it and going, no, why do you keep doing that? You could just do this. Or
but the characters have to exist. Listen
to what the characters are telling you. Mm-hmm. But you do have to try and do that. Honestly, listen to, you know, and also sometimes, you know, not go for the easy out or oh, this an audience would like this, thinking that's the best way. You know, I think I've helped myself along the way many times by saying, this is where the characters wanted to go, whether you like it or not. This is what the ending is supposed to be. It's not me saying I want it to be this or this is what I know an audience would like more. This ending is abrupt and sad, but that's how it's supposed to end, you know, right now anyway. I've certainly done that on stage and screen. But more so is probably the other direction where I've been writing, you know, I'm writing something and I get to like, you know, page 50 and I'm like, my hands are starting to ring a little bit going, man, something should be happening right now. You know, these people have talked for a long time and I like the talk, but somebody's got to get up from the table here at some point. Someone's got to do something. And I feel like I've written my premise into the corner and it, you know, and it doesn't actually work as a whole. So that can, I guess, happen from either end, but I'm good about going back and rewriting. That's one good thing about me is I've taught, you know, in the past and I've met a lot of people, whether they're students or just writers at various things. And inevitably you find some question and a number of people at those things who are like, oh, what do you do about rewriting? You know, as if it's like just this labor where I'm like, I just do it. I mean, so it's writing. I mean, you call it rewriting, but it's part of the process. I love it as much as the writing process. So I've never found it to be a struggle. And like, oh my God, I can't go back to those characters. I'm like, I do it all the time. And so it's harder for me to understand what you hate about it so much. But what I will tell you is you got to do it, you know, in the same way that you have to actually sit down and write in the first place to ever have anything to read. So there's no, yeah, people are often looking for keys, you know, tricks. Like how do I do it? How do I unlock the mystery box?
They're just shortcuts. Yeah. And it's what's not the,
what's
worth
the trick to get them? Like the trick is there's no trick, you know, and that's the good news and the bad news. It's just, you've got to keep tapping your fingers until you have a stack of stuff. And if that stuff isn't, you know, gold yet, you run it back through the processor until, you know, you've got something. And there's no real shortcut to that. You know,
and I hate to tell you, Geekscape, it's got to be a page one. Like it has to, because it's not a process of rewriting. If you shift your focus to a process of educating yourself and delving deeper, and it's paleontology more than anything.
Hmm.
And you have to just go back to the softer tools and just be like, okay, well, I got that far.
Yeah.
I mean, Geekscape, I don't have to tell you, you like video games. You don't beat the video game on the first time you play it. If you lose, you got to go back to the beginning of the video game and start it over again.
God bless them if they do. But yeah, I have met writers who are so precious about their stuff, and they don't want to change anything. And I'm like, God bless that you know, this magic shit comes out of you that is perfect the first time. How did you do that? I would love to know, because it's never happened to me. And I've done this so many times, and yet it's never been perfect. And it's never perfect even on the set. When, you know, it's so funny that somebody has, you know, they're like, oh, hey, what about this is the final line? And you're like, great idea. Or you get to all the way to the editing process. You've written the thing, you've rewritten it, you've cast it, you've shot it. And then you get there and an editor goes, do we need this scene? Yeah. You're like, oh yeah, that was the problem. We don't need this scene. I saved half a day of shooting, but I didn't see it, you know? So it's a good thing. What you should really do is have a lot of people read things and not be afraid of someone not loving what you've done. But, you know, a good idea is way better than a warm hug when it comes to writing sometimes. You know, you really need someone who's honest enough to tell you what they really think.
And when you get to the end of one of these films, which ones are, in looking back, are the ones that educated you and propelled you forward and said, wow, I learned a lesson there? These all feel like a sense of education for you. Yeah, like I mean,
every time, right?
This is you digging your stuff, and we're watching and we're enjoying it. Neil, don't get self-conscious. We're watching you dig through your stuff and trying to see how pieces
bounce. Some more than others.
But it's
you learn something every time. But often, you know, as much with the ones where you feel like you've got it right, the ones where you've got it, what ultimately you listen to people and you think, wow, people didn't like that as much. You learn as much from that, or if not more, that, you know, what went wrong or what, you know, didn't click with people. The stage play that I think, you know, is the, like, I would consider the one that got away, is probably the one that I rewrote the most. But, you know, there was something in there that I still just legitimately feel like I didn't quite land.
Didn't crack it.
But not for want of trying. You know, I've got more drafts of that and scenes from that than anything else on my computer. But I still don't feel like I unlocked the perfect center of it.
Is it on its feet? Did you make it?
Oh, yeah. And it's been...
What was it called?
It was called The Break of Noon.
Yeah.
And I love the premise. I love the script. The productions that I've seen, I was, you know, happy with the actors, and all, but there was something in there. I felt like I didn't quite land something in there that made the journey exactly right. But I go back and tinker on stuff all the time.
Did Neil live enough life by that point, or not enough life? I mean, when you think about your approach,
there was plenty of life.
Yeah.
There were plenty of skills. I just, sometimes they get away from you.
The fish breaks the line and swims away. And when you look at something like The Wicker Man, that, like, I haven't seen The Wicker Man, Geekscape, it's because y'all just threw a bunch of memes on the internet and it just turned into, like, you know what I mean? And so when you have something like a remake, and there are some form of parameters going in, how does that exploratory process play out for you with something like a remake?
Well, it's, you know, you ultimately find out, oh my God, people, you know, love this movie in a way that you didn't realize, or you went in thinking we can make this out of that. But in that particular case, it felt like we probably had too many cooks in the kitchen trying to make something, and ultimately didn't decide exactly on what we wanted to make. But I had a great time doing it. Nick was a blast to work with. But that was one that felt like, oh yeah, maybe that got away from us. But again, not for want of trying. You know, you work as hard on the ones that aren't successful as the ones that are. And what makes one click with an audience and one not? It's, if I knew that, I would probably be teaching more than I do.
Right. And when you look at the last couple of movies, and obviously there's a reality in theatrical and post-COVID and during, even before COVID, it felt like if you weren't a Marvel movie, you were going to make a smaller and smaller film. Does it feel like these films are more honest to Neil DeBute than were something like Wicker Man, that because of the production value of it, the size of it, it did have inherently more cooks? Maybe are these more Neil DeBute films that you're making now?
I think so. I mean, there's certainly more of a size like what I started out with. And I think, you know, the more control for good or bad, you know, whether you like it or not, regardless of that, you feel like you have created what you set out to create, you know, the more control you have over that product. So those films that cost $25,000 the first time you made one, but, you know, a $1 million movie, you know, that has very few producers and lets you, you know, make it the way you want to make it, like House of Darkness, you feel like that is what you set out to do. And it looks a whole lot like what you had in your head from the very beginning.
Well, Geekscape, I'm just going to tell you one last time. I loved this movie. I thought it was great. And again, I'm not a horror person, but I am a Neil DeBute fan. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the show, Neil. I am a fan. And I loved the way that you put all the pieces in place in this little game that was being played in these characters. The movie is out in theaters September 9th, on demand and digital September 13th. Neil, I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show. And
pleasure. Thank you.
We'll watch the next one. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you.
Geekscapists, how cool was that? Neil DeBute was super nice. If you enjoyed that, we've got some cool stuff coming up. Later this week, I've got Peter Jockel. He's a filmmaker out of Prague, and he's got a brand new film. It's actually the most expensive Czechoslovakian film ever made, but it's got some Hollywood stars. Ben Foster's in it, Michael Caine, and it's a real kick-ass medieval epic. And I think you should check it out. It's called Medieval, and we talk all about it coming up later this week on Geekscape. So please, subscribe, share it with your friends. And if you're on one of those podcatchers, leave us a 5-star review. That really helps out our visibility, and it helps us get more of these awesome interviews like the one you just enjoyed. Until then, thanks so much, Geekscapists. Don't hate, create.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.